Hello again, welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I talk to British star Jason Isaacs, who's back from Edinburgh with a smile on his face and a trophy in his hand, as cast and director of Skeletons celebrate taking the Michael Powell Award for Best New British Feature Film. And as all eyes are focused on South Africa at the moment, director Ralph Zeman's timing is impeccable as he releases his gangland movie, Jerusalemma, about a crime boss on the rise in post-apartheid Johannesburg. Also, I'll be picking out the best of this week's releases, including the ogre-turned-jolly-green-giant Shrek. Yes, he's back. Director Claire Denis is here with White Material, and there's a French-style rom-com, Heartbreaker. Yes, it's a podcast with more than a few skeletons in the cupboard. It's Film Weekly.
Everything all right with you two?
Yeah.
Yes, boss.
I won't go into details, but Faulkner and Gabriel are no longer operational, which means I'm looking for a new A-team. It's crunch time, boys. I need to know you can think outside the box, that you can use the procedure to its full potential. That's how come the change of job. Could be tricky. Data required on an absent subject. Gonna need some lateral thinking. But you get this right, could be your ticket out of the domestic, into the global stuff. Politicians, aristos. Got the Saxe Coburg's lined up early next year. Imagine the filth. Make the goal of Jackie O look like the Partridge Family, eh? Don't let me down. It's your chance to shine.
That was our Jason Isaacs there as the mystery boss man, the Colonel, in Nick Whitfield's Skeletons, released this week as part of the New British Quarterly, given a big fillip, of course, by winning the Michael Powell Award at Edinburgh last week. And if that clip left you wondering what on earth is going on, the film does keep you guessing for quite a while too. It's about an odd couple of psychic cleaners, Davis and Bennett, played by Ed Gochen and Andrew Buckley, traipsing around the West Country and revealing the psychic fears and secrets of their unsuspecting clients. To tell me more about it, but not too much, I hope, Jason Isaacs joins me now. Where are you, Jace?
I'm sitting in my trailer on the Harry Potter set, or what was the Harry Potter set, and is in fact just a building site as they deconstruct everything.
Oh my God, is that not terribly sad, somewhere where you've spent like the last sort of 7 years of your life?
It's incredibly upsetting. And I came in to do some interviews for international telly, and it just so happens to be the day that most things are getting boxed up, and it's disturbing, yeah.
Oh, there's nothing so sad as, like, you know, a magician's hat in a box, triangular box.
No, Dan's still here. Dan's doing a tiny bit of something rather than some last little pickup.
Then he's got to let it go. Tell him he's going to have to let it go.
Well, he's fine. Obviously, he's going on to Broadway, but there's a lot of crew members here, you know, the makeup and hair and drivers and all these people who are wondering what they're going to do next.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a shame when a massive franchise like that kind of goes out of the British film industry. Maybe they will come along with another one. It certainly served you very well, Jace. I mean, everyone kind of says, oh, because we were up in Edinburgh together just now, and it was like Harry Potter star Jason Isaacs. And
it's given me the middle name I never had. I always wanted a middle name. I'm now Jason Brackett, Lucius Malfoy Isaacs, and will be till the day I die, which... it's a label I wear quite proudly.
But what it has done is sort of enabled you to kind of go and do your Harry Potter stuff and then go off and do some American series and then do some you know, big films like Green Zone. And then, of course, this little film, Skeletons, which we're here to talk about today, which...
exactly.
Which you remember you told me about a year ago. You'd done this film and it was going to go nowhere. No one was ever going to go and see it. And it shows what you know, because it's just won the Michael Powell Award at Edinburgh for the Best New British Feature
Film. I hope I didn't sell it that way. I think I probably said I've done a really magnificent, beautiful little film and I'm hoping that people will see it. I hope that's what I said.
You said it was brilliant and that you loved it, and that's why you did it. So why did you do it? Because it is such a small film, and, you know, and here
it's
you are, Harry
film,
Potter
but,
star
know,
Jason Isaacs.
Yeah, but, you know, we're all, everybody I know in this business is led by scripts, and I was sent an email with an invitation to do something with a link to a short film that the filmmaker Nick Whitfield had already made. I watched it, it was fantastic, and I didn't even need to read the script. I thought, there is a man of real, rare, and a kind of idiosyncratically unique talent, and that's... I mean, there are so many people out there who are skilled, who are making things like other people. But to find someone who has a voice that you've not heard before was a rather special thing. Well, my trailer door is being knocked on right now. So
is that Daniel? If it's Daniel Radcliffe, welcome in.
Thank you. No, I'm being given a loop. One of the things that actors have to do, this is behind the curtain stuff, is they give you a big book of photographs of yourself. And you look through with a little magnifying glass and you cross through in pencil the ones that you don't think are flattering enough. And
is this in character? Is this in character or as
in character? In character that they can use to press. You get to a certain age and you find you're crossing out an awful lot more than you used to. They've just handed me through a magnifying, there's a little thing called a loop, which is a magnifying glass for looking at contact sheets. And what they should do is give me one with slightly less magnifying power. Yes. Meanwhile, but we digress. Skeletons. It is a fantastic film. And, you know, I saw the short film, I thought, I'm in. And then I already committed, basically, I phoned my agent and said, I'm in, these people are great. And then I read the script and I saw that he managed to take the already brilliant concept, which he'd used for the short film, and fully expand it. The short film led you to, you know, gave you loads of questions. It doesn't feel like a concept stretched. It feels instead like this world that he explores in Skeletons you'd like to watch five films about, and that's a real feat.
Could you tell us a little bit about your character, the Colonel, and in particular this wonderful kind of throat cut that he's got that goes all the way around the neck, like an instructions to cut here.
Well, that's what happens. That's absolutely right. That's how I thought of it, oddly. But because the two of them are so physically striking, Andy's so big and hulking, and Ed's kind of little and exaggerates his hunch for it, and because they're so funny and well-established, I thought I'd better do something bold. If I'm coming in as this bloke who's their boss, who commands this organisation, I need to, you know, I need to hit the ground running, as it were, and turn this duo into a triangle and or trio. And so I came up with this, as many bold and surreal choices as I could, and each one of them, the director rubbed his hands with glee and went, oh yeah, let's do that then. So I said, he's got a hat and he never takes it off, even when he goes to bed. And he went, oh, I like that, that's good. I said, and he's got, he's had his throat cut from ear to ear in some mysterious, probably in a French Foreign Legion, and it means that he talks like someone who's had his vocal cords sawn through with a bread knife. And he went, yeah, I like that. And I thought, how far can I go with this? I had a moustache, obviously, because that's now my whole new motif. For
yeah, you're good with moustaches.
Yeah, and because he was called the Colonel, I thought, I don't know why he's called the Colonel, but I feel that sometime in his life, before he got into this kind of surreal, existential, whatever they are, I don't know, what are they? Are they exorcists for the soul or something?
Yeah, emotional cleaners or emotional exorcists, they've been described as.
It's almost, anyway, I thought that's what he had a previous life in the military. One of the things that I find interesting and tricky and challenging about promoting this film and persuading people that they should go and see it. It's all very well, and thank God we've now won an award. You can say, look, a whole bunch of the great and the good have said this is a fabulous film.
Including
Sir Patrick Stewart, make it so, number one. But it's also true that you have to tell people who don't know that what the film's about, and I struggle. I keep coming up with these insubstantial hybrids. I say, oh, it's Charlie Kaufman meets Terry Gilliam meets Ken Loach or something.
Yeah, it is on a very small, but I mean, it has to me that wistfulness that Charlie Kaufman managed to get on sort of Being John Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine, where it's kind of people wanting to interfere emotionally with stuff that's very sort of
untenable. Yeah, and it's kind of magical and surreal. So you watch these surreal things, these bizarre men going into people's pasts with this kind of timeless, odd, Victorian-looking equipment.
Yeah.
And you never question for a second that this is just a real, it's a service that people can provide. It's just like people who turn up to get rid of your rats. And only when you come out of it at the end and you try and describe it to someone else do you realise how absurd and surreal it was at the time. It's kind of whimsical and engaging and moving. And that, I think, is what gives it the quality of a dream, because don't you sometimes wake up from a dream and go, how did it seem logical that people spoke through their fingers? I never questioned it for a second in my dream.
It had to be a sort of touch of the Edwardian about it, that sort of photographing fairies, that kind of Houdini kind of...
Absolutely. And, I mean, I thought the production design... sometimes things just work. All the elements work.
And the two actors that you play with, I'd never seen them before, Ed and Andy, Ed Gochen and Andy Buckley, they are... I mean, they obviously had a good relationship
going... Well, they're a long-established double act. I mean, it needs to be said, I'm not only not the lead, I'm nowhere near the lead in this film... But I led my whatever minor celebrity status I lent to them making a film with two people who've not been seen by the public much before, who are utterly brilliant.
They're
a
good,
comedy
aren't they?
Double act who have been together for years and have that kind of ease in each other's company and the ability to improvise on top of each other that puts you in mind of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore or any of the Pythons or, you know, I don't know, Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, well, people talk about Laurel and Hardy because they're sort of one's tall and one's small and sort of one's fatter and one's smaller. And
I thought the production design served so beautifully the kind of timeless world that Nick created.
Yeah, I mean, presumably that's why it won the Michael Powell Award, as you say. Being up there for that, because you were up there not only as part of Skeletons as well, but you were up there the whole time because you were on the jury of the International.
I was on the jury, as well. Yeah.
How was that for you?
It was quite interesting, actually. It was instructive. I mean, first of all, there's some fabulous films, some not quite so fabulous, but all of them were shirking that pressure that people face to tell similar stories in a similar way. You know, you see a lot more films than I, but almost all films nowadays made are made not just not the word is not cynically, I suppose, but they're made with the fear and expectation and hope of being like something else. Or it's got to be exactly in the vein of one of the working titles, successful
rom-com.
Yeah,
Four Weddings.
So anybody who's trying to tell a different story, it's really taking their, you know, their life, their fortunes, their career in their hands, because it's difficult to get made and it's difficult to get it seen, which is why film festivals and prizes and the fact that you're giving me the chance to tell people how brilliant Skeletons is incredibly important.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I loved it, if only for its, you know, I did like it very much, but if mainly for its kind of fact that I'd never seen it before. You know, that's a great thing for a critic, to kind of see something new and fresh. Jason Isaacs, good luck looking at yourself and poring over your pictures. I'm sure you're very handsome.
That's very kind of you. Bye.
Cheers, Jason. If you're just a mortal like me and can't use extrasensory perception to find out where you can see Skeletons, we're here to help. The film gets a UK-wide release from this Friday, the 2nd of July, and you can find out where it'll be playing as it goes on tour as part of the New British Cinema Quarterly at nbcq.co.uk. You can also see an exclusive and extended clip of the film by going to guardian.co.uk/film. And so to some of the other releases out this week. French director Claire Denis is at the top of her game right now. Last year's Parisian snapshot, 35 Shots of Rum, was one of our favourites on this show, and she's followed it up now with White Material. Isabelle Huppert plays Maria Vial, a coffee plantation owner in Cameroon. I only assume it's Cameroon from a couple of posters of footballers of the indomitable Lions green strip on some of the bedroom walls. Bit of detective work for you there. Maria is stubbornly clinging to her old way of life, while all around, her workers are fleeing in the face of fighting between rebel soldiers, led by the mysterious figure of the Boxer and the government troops. Corruption and death are everywhere, but Maria is in some sort of dust cloud of denial, desperately keeping her coffee and her family alive, while her beloved African soil runs ever deeper with blood. Denis is an elliptical filmmaker at the best of times, but White Material, the title comes from the consumer stuff the child rebels loot from the plantation, is one of her clearer pictures, anchored by a sinewy performance from Huppert. I loved its atmosphere and tension, a physical, sensual film that gets right under the skin and bones of its locations and lead character. The other face of French cinema, the commercial one, arrives with the glossy star vehicle rom-com Heartbreaker.
Voici Juliette von der Beck. Tu as 10 jours pour mettre fin à leur relation.
Pourquoi?
Parce que dans 10 jours, ils se marient.
Vous êtes qui?
Je suis votre garde du corps.
Son volant avec ça me paraissait un peu léger.
L'efficacité ne se mesure pas à la carrure.
Romain Duris, so brilliant for Jacques Audiard in the Beat My Heart skip, turns on the comic charm to play a con artist who, through elaborate scenarios paid for by angry fathers and worried relatives, seduces women away from their intended fiancés. Vanessa Paradis is about to marry Andrew Lincoln. Yep, Egg from this life, remember him? But her gangster boss dad hires Romain to woo her away. Cue a farcical high-concept romance set in the glamorous environs of Monaco, where Duris, posing as Vanessa's bodyguard, has to pretend to like Roquefort for breakfast, the songs of Wham, and the filmic brilliance of Dirty Dancing. Will Vanessa fall for him or stick with her goody-two-loafers Brit? Frankly, I didn't give a damn. The leads are never likeable nor believable, and the premise becomes tiresome, particularly if you can't stand Dirty Dancing. Duris also works with two totally unhilarious comedy cohorts, and I found laughs and charm, two key ingredients to a romantic comedy, wouldn't you say, in very thin supply here. Monsieur Vanessa Paradis, or you know him as Johnny Depp, is the narrator for When You're Strange, a film about the Doors, directed by indie king Tom DeCillo. It's a rather straightforward documentary about America's most, and I quote, dark and dangerous band. Ooh.
It's John's idea to slow down the middle of L.A. woman. Jim comes up with a phrase he wants to repeat over and over. After they record it, Jim scribbles something on a piece of paper and shows it to the group.
With the mojo rising.
Using previously unseen footage and a short film Jim Morrison made himself, DeCillo looks at how the band came together and made 6 albums in under 5 years. He examines their musical influences and sound, and shows some fine concert material too, before drugs, booze and ego took Mr. Mojo Rising away from us and into Père Lachaise Cemetery at the age of 27. Surprisingly, given that DeCillo's feature films such as Living in Oblivion and The Real Blonde are funny and ironic about media and celebrity, This documentary is po-faced and wholly in love with its subject. Depp is so serious in his narration, he could be reading out a funeral sermon. The film manages to make being in a rock and roll band look like a massive pain in the arse, rather than the sex and drugs-fueled giggle it surely must have been for Morrison. Finally, a word for the last, I swear, Shrek movie, which is in 3D, but doesn't really make the most of it. In Shrek Forever After, Shrek is in midlife crisis, worrying he's lost his roar since becoming domesticated and henpecked with Fiona. He signs a contract with Rumpelstiltskin in which he gets a day to be an ogre again, and Rumpel sneakily gets to steal away a day from Shrek's childhood. Yep, it's the day he was born, so Shrek never really existed, and Far Far Away now belongs to Stiltskin, and it's all very Potter's Field and Jimmy Stewart.
Pull it out for you.
You gave me a day from your past, a day you wouldn't even remember. Wow. A day when you were an innocent, mindless baby.
You took the day I was born.
No, Shrek.
You gave it to me.
Enjoy this while you can, Steelskin, because when this day is up...
But, you haven't heard the best part. Since you were never born, once this day comes to an end, so will you.
They're all here, Donkey and Puss, all voiced by Mike Myers, Eddie Murphy, Antonio Banderas, Cameron Diaz, et al. But there's no real joy in the animation or the script. It all feels very much like ticking off the numbers all the way to the dragon-dominated climax. It's not a bad way to keep the little ones quiet through the summer, I guess, but even they will come out saying what we all know. It wasn't as good as the first one, was it, Daddy? With the World Cup in full swing, most of us are thinking about the humiliation of an early exit, but this week sees the release of a film that the South African Tourist Board probably would not be best pleased about. Jerusalema is a Scarface Godfather City of God-style gangster film set in the post-apartheid years and following the rise to power of Lucky Kunene, petty criminal turned property mogul.
I'm Lucky Kunene. This is my associate, Zeke Mbule.
Well, do you what?
We represent the Hillbrow People's Housing Trust.
I don't give money to hawkers.
We are not hawkers, Mr. Santos Ribeiro. And we are certainly not looking for charity.
How do you know my name?
We are here to discuss Dan Vista Mansions.
Dan Vista Mansions? What do I have to discuss with you?
If you'd actually bother to visit the building, I think you'd be aware of the appalling condition it's in.
Why don't you mind your own business?
It is my business. I'm putting all of you slum landlords
on... How slum landlord me? That building was in perfect condition till there were 20 people living in a single
flat. You mean 20 black people?
Don't pull that race shit. I never said black people. I want to know what you're up to.
We, the Hillbrow People's Housing Trust, are collecting rent and holding it in trust until this matter is resolved to our satisfaction. Take my card. When you've decided you're willing to talk, call.
I met up with Ralph Zeman, director of Jerusalema, to learn more about the dark side of Johannesburg, and I asked him if he knew when he made the film that the World Cup would be looming and the spotlight would be shining so brightly on South Africa.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been rushing up at us for a while, you know, so we were aware of it even when we shot the film, you know, that the World Cup would be upon us.
There is even a silhouette of Soccer City. I think the stadium makes it into your movie.
There is a silhouette, in fact, we'd actually shot some scenes in Soccer City, which didn't make it into the final cut.
I mean, because this is obviously not the sort of Johannesburg that we're seeing on the television much, but it must be interesting for you to kind of examine it as a South African yourself, who's been living here in the UK and then in Los Angeles, to come back to what I presume is your hometown and the land of your birth at such a time. Where so much is focused on it, not just even the World Cup, but even, I suppose, Clint Eastwood's film Invictus, and examining that the kind of post-apartheid legacy.
Yeah, I think South Africa is like a, you know, very multifaceted place, and you know, you certainly get it in the film. I mean, one of the interesting things is, yes, Soccer City is featured in the film, but Ellis Park Stadium, where some of the where some of the soccer matches were held, the other big stadium in Johannesburg, is right across the road from Hillbrow. It's literally, you walk down the hill and cross the road and you're there. So it's not, you know, it's not very far from home, you
right.
know?
And the Hillbrow is the area that one of the characters dubs the crime capital of the world. And this is the place where our main man Lucky kind of rises to prominence. This is a sort of slum landlord, really.
Yeah, he was a slum landlord. you know, it was based on a real guy who had a syndicate who'd taken over, you know, 20, 30, 40 buildings in Hillbrow, downtown Johannesburg. And, you know, he was pulling in at the time, I'd heard, something in the region, 10, 20 million rand a month in cash, which is probably £1 million or so a month in cash in rent. And, you know, he'd done it through this combination of, you know, people's dissatisfaction with the, you know, terrible living conditions they were in, but also, you know, through cunning and thuggery and intimidation. And, you know, he would get the residents together and he would form non-profit housing trusts and collect the rent and hold it in trust and fix up the building. So it's a kind of a very interesting, it's a very contemporary story of modern day Johannesburg.
What's interesting about it is the kind of shifting morality for us, because yes, we watch him kind of seize these possessions back off white landlords, yes, and seize them for himself. So he's dubbed, of course, Robin Hood for a little while. But then it turns out, was that new ruling class, the new South Africa, better than the old South Africa? That's the kind of crux of your film.
And I think we wanted that to be ambiguous, because in many ways it wasn't. He was based on a real character, and the real character had told me, you know, this was our land and whites came and they took it away, and now I'm taking it back, and does that make me a criminal? And I'm taking it back from slumlords and people who, you know, charging people and giving them the worst living conditions. And, you know, so it was always a dubious morality and a lot of difficult questions that, you know, I as the filmmaker, the writer, don't necessarily know the answer to, but, like, nevertheless, I mean, I think they're very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I assume you as a filmmaker struggled with your own moral problem, because there's a character in your film, a Jewish character, mm-hmm, beautifully played, mm-hmm, which I assume there's some of you in that family, who comes down and says, and Lucky says to her, well, what's a nice girl like you, mm-hmm, doing in a place like this? Basically, what is the attraction of poverty to a kind of nice white liberal South African, yeah, Jew? Well, I'm going to ask you the same, Ralph.
Well, as she said in the film, slumming it. No, I think that for me, what really attracted me to it was that there's a lot of conflict in places like Hillbrow, and there's a lot of, and that makes for good stories. The fact that you've got these inner cities where living conditions are very bad and people are very poor, and there's lots of drugs, and there's immigrants from all over Africa, Nigeria, Congo, Angola, Mozambique. It's this melting pot. And, you know, I think that's what, like, as a filmmaker draws me to it. It's, you know, I suppose what goes on in the more genteel areas is probably, you know, not as interesting.
I mean, we see them, you know, we see the Jewish family, we see, yeah, the white, I think he must be Portuguese or Brazilian.
Portuguese.
The kind of guy originally owns the slum landlord, yeah, kind of the original, the white
the
slum
original
landlord.
Slum landlord, yeah.
So we see those areas, and those are very important to show.
Because I think up until that point in the film, you've seen Lucky grows up in Soweto, and then you see the inner city, and, you know, it's not very far from Hillbrow. You know, it's about 3 or 4 miles, and a lot of people who live in the suburbs will never go there.
Now, you grew up there yourself in Johannesburg.
I grew up in Johannesburg. As I keep telling everyone, I was born in Hillbrow. I grew up in suburban Johannesburg. But I knew Hillbrow very well because, you know, as a teenager, you'd go there. There was the clubs. There was the only record shops where you could buy imported albums and... you know,
is that where you went to score weed as well?
Hillbrow was a place where people always went to get drugs.
And it seems to sort of tap into a sort of filmmaking genre. Mm. I noticed that there's a... Is there a... I'm looking at the poster, the quotes behind. No one's kind of drawn City of God into it. But there were times where it reminded me of that. And that, yeah, also features... That's Fernando Moreira, yes, making a film about the favelas there. Let's call them the townships here. Did you feel as a filmmaker going in there a duty to kind of present in some way, or did you feel that could grow as your experience grew of getting to know the characters?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Hillbrow is definitely a place where it is controlled by drug lords, mostly Nigerian cartels, which have come in and control them. And what has also happened is that South Africa, in the years after apartheid, had become the biggest transshipment point for cocaine going to Europe. So generally it comes from Brazil, South America, through the port at Maputo, through Johannesburg Airport, and onto Amsterdam. So, you know, one of the bright byproducts of that is that a lot of cheap cocaine winds up in Johannesburg, and a lot of, you know, nice middle-class white kids from the suburbs would wind up going into places like Hillbrow to score and to do drugs. And it was a common story. What would often happen was the drug dealers would extend them credit. They'd let them party for days. They'd give them as much, you know, coke, crack, freebase as they wanted. And, you know, after 3 or 4 days, they would phone the family and say, listen, now you come and pay, or if you're not here in an hour, if you're not here in 3 hours, we're going to kill your son, your brother. And that's something that, that did happen a lot, and often people, if somebody didn't arrive, they would be killed. So that was the way we brought the white characters into the story, and that was, you know, that's how they'd wound up in Hillbrow, and that's how Lucky had wound up, you know, discovering the suburbs and, you know, what was to him the more aspirational parts of Johannesburg.
Did you feel that, because in a way it's not a pretty picture that you paint of Johannesburg post-apartheid, whereas I think most people, if you look at Invictus, would have said, oh, it's a bright new tomorrow, hooray, we win the Rugby World Cup and everyone's dancing in the streets together, marvellous.
Right.
Clearly your film puts a much more trickier and, I assume, more realistic path on it.
Yeah.
Where are we now? And I'm really talking about almost the crack cocaine that is the World Cup, the kind of quick fix that FIFA throw at the country, and, you know, maybe in a way kind of give the populace some kind of thing. I mean, this is soccer, not rugby, remember, it's a kind of black sport. So, you know, where's the relationship now? Has it moved on since Gangster's Paradise, or are we still living in a Gangster's Paradise?
You know, I think the crime migrates from one thing to the next, but hard to say whether it's better or worse, but, you know, it's probably round about the same. I mean, and, you know, the crime is a huge problem in South Africa. And look, I mean, I'm happy the World Cup seems to have gone off really well. And, you know, South Africa needs all the positive stories we can. But, you know, sometimes as a filmmaker, much like we talked about slumming it earlier on, you know, you're not necessarily in, you know, you are shining a light on it. There's people who live in Johannesburg who never set foot in Hillbrow. Well, at least if they see the film, they see what it looks like. They realize what people live with on a day-to-day basis. You realize you have, you know, this area in the middle of town where there's buildings that have no electricity, no running water. Some of them have no sewage. Human waste is thrown out of the window, you know, in the middle of the night and onto the streets, and it runs in open sewers down the streets. And that's a facet of modern-day South Africa. It's a facet of modern-day Johannesburg. Now, there's been criticism from, you know, elements in the government saying, you're not showing us in a good light, you're not promoting this country very well. Well, you know, I say to them, you're the government, do something about it, and then there'll be nothing for people like me to show anymore. And that would be a good place to be.
And Jerusalem goes on UK-wide release from Friday the 9th of July. That's next week. So thanks to Ralph Zeman there and to all my guests on the show this week, including Jason Isaacs, of course. To read the best film news and reviews, I'm sitting in again for the great Philip French. So every film out this week is reviewed by moi. The music this week was from some of the films we featured, including the score to Skeletons by Simon Whitfield, director's brother. So all that's left to say is that if you're sick of the sunshine or the football, go to the movies. From me, Jason Solomons, and from my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye until next week.